You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Hey guys, Steve here. You are listening to one of our original 26 episodes. If you've listened to any of our new episodes, you're going to notice that we're sounding a little different in these ones.
Yeah, there's a reason for that.
There is.
They've been remastered.
They have been remastered.
Because they had a really annoying hum.
Yeah, I mean, a huge thanks to listener James for doing almost all of the legwork on this
yes.
thing.
Yeah.
You'll also notice if you had listened to what we're calling the Lost 26 episodes before, and you're re-listening now, the music and sound effects are gone.
Yes, yeah. we've gone back to straight audio. So be warned, we sound a little different today than we do in what you're about to listen to.
Yeah.
Enjoy. Uh-huh.
Bye.
Okay, bye.
Thinking Sideways.
Understand.
Does not compute.
You never know.
What?
Stories of things we simply don't know the answer to.
Well, hi there. I'm Steve.
I'm Devin.
I'm Joe.
Put the three of us in a room and you got Thinking Sideways, the podcast.
Yay!
The show where we tend to look at things that don't really have a clear answer and then we try to figure them out.
Mm.
And once again, believe it or not, we've got another one.
Oh.
Anybody else surprised?
No, not really.
No.
You wouldn't have called this meeting unless you had something.
You're right.
That's why we're, it's usually why we're here in the studio.
Yes, it's very, very true. Well, this week I've got quite an interesting one that I want to go over, which is 1991 VG. In late 1991, an object was spotted in space coming towards our planet. It was initially described as a near-Earth object, which is what a lot of asteroids and stuff are called. You know,
things that come uncomfortably close.
Yeah, but we don't know if it's actually going to hit us or just kind of glance by.
Did it destroy the Earth?
Obviously not.
Oh. Mm,
right. It was spotted by a guy named Jim Scotty, and Mr. Scotty was tracking this NEO, as they refer to him, with SpaceWatch, which is a telescope in Kitt Peak National Observatory, which is in Arizona.
Yeah.
He found it by accident, to be quite honest. Evidently, the range that they look at, he had, for some reason, set the telescope lower than normal and just happened to catch this thing coming along.
Yeah, my understanding of it is that actually they use software to pick out anomalies, things that are moving against the background.
Mm-hmm.
So he actually, it wasn't the telescope, but the software. He set the range for the software.
Is that how?
And so the software picked this thing up.
I couldn't quite get my head around it. There's a lot of science-y stuff in this one, ladies and gentlemen, and I've been struggling through this for weeks to get my head around it. But thank you, Joe. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
So he spots this thing, and like I said, he called it an NEO, and they named it 1991 VG, and they didn't know what it was, but they thought it was going to hit the planet. When it was first spotted, this thing was 0.0031 AU away from the Earth. And AU is an astronomical unit. Okay, like I said, there's a lot of science in this one. Here's how they make these generalizations so that it's not a gazillion, gazillion, gazillion miles.
Mm-hmm.
They say, what's the distance from the Earth to the sun on average?
Mm-hmm.
And that's one unit.
Oh.
So when you break that down, how close is it? It was 0.0031 astronomical units, which means it's, you know, 3/100ths of the distance from the Earth or from the Earth to the sun
is 96 million miles. So
it was super far away. Actually, it was approximately 2,046,000 miles away.
Yeah.
So just as hard to say.
And approaching us.
Yes. Yeah. And approaching us. But he figured it was an asteroid. But as he started watching this thing, he noticed that it was winking, as they say, meaning that every 7.5 minutes it would flash and then go dark. and then flash and go dark. So time goes by and this thing is doing what an asteroid wouldn't normally do, because if you think about something that's spherical in space, it should have light on it on a relatively consistent basis, not turning on, turning off.
Sure.
But this thing was doing that, which is weird. When they did the analysis of it, they figured out this thing was approximately 10 meters across, so about 30 feet across, which isn't really big.
Yeah. Especially for space objects.
Yeah, it's something in space. It's not that big. Okay, we can deal with that.
Sure.
Although, they would classify it as a S-class meteor based on its size. If it was larger than that, I guess it was a C-class. But S-class meteors don't have this reflective quality to them. Plus, I think it's the way their shape is.
Are there any other examples of S-class meteors, like famous ones?
I'm sure there are, but I didn't pull any for my research.
That's fair.
And one thing about the way they guesstimated its size is by the amount of light it was sending in our direction. And that's based on the average reflectivity for your average meteor, your average meteoroid in space.
Most things aren't very reflective in space.
Yeah. In other words, it's based on that on that particular assumption that they made. So it could have been five times as large but less reflective.
That's true.
Or smaller and more reflective.
You know, half the size but super reflective.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. But the thing is, the reflectivity of it was what caused all the hubbub, because its nature was to reflect light in the same manner that a rotating satellite would. In other words, a metallic object would. So it's got a dark side. It's got facets on it. And so they pick up and they all shine the light back at once. And then they go dark because it's spun around. So in other words, it couldn't be a sphere.
Right.
It's got to be something with some kind of sharp angles.
And actually, some meteoroids and asteroids are not actually spherical. A lot of them are like just brick shaped and they rotate.
Yeah.
This was actually one of the things that I think I was reading about in the... Maybe it was in the research, maybe when I was doing some research, but they were talking about how a lot of things we call asteroids or meteors are actually just big glumps of stuff. It's not like one rock, right? Mm-hmm. It's like a big mass of debris or whatever.
Yeah. And it's all got gravity force holding it together.
The way that gravity affects that then is it pulls it into this kind of monolithic structure more than a sphere, because, you know, when it's rotating, it's got like a side that's being pulled more, and then it rotates more, and there's a side that's being pulled more. Does that make sense?
Like Play-Doh in space, essentially. Yeah. It stretches and pulls and moves around.
Yeah. So that was a thing they were talking about that happens sometimes in space, but I don't know that really explains the reflective quality, the more reflective of some sides than others. Although I guess if, you know, one side had more whatever kind of rocks that are super reflective, maybe, but
it's got a crystalline side and a bare rock side.
Yeah.
Or if it's an irregularly shaped thing and it's got a flat side that when it rotates around, suddenly that flat side is illuminated.
There's a lot of very simple answers for this thing. The one thing that caught everybody off guard was the reflectivity and the way that it rotated was akin to a metallic object. That looked more like it was a pre-made shape rather than just some happen upon shape by random rocks.
Yeah.
When it went by, so they found it, like I said, in November of 91, and it got its closest to, or October, excuse me, and it got closest to the planet in November. They hit it with radar to try to get some readings off of it or figure a little more out. But I'm guessing that there was some kind of interference. They didn't get good data from it. And then it went on about its merry way and is now somewhere. It's gone in space on its orbit, and we're not going to see it again until 2017.
And now, can you describe the orbit of it? Because right now I'm picturing that it's like a Halley's Comet situation where it's on some weird kind of, you know, boomerangs around the sun and goes out to like Pluto and comes back and situation. And, you know, we intersect with it once every, 1,000 years or something that.
It's on a heliocentric orbit, which means that it is rotating around the sun. And it's also on a orbital axis that is the same as our planet. So if you think about the orbit of the planet around the sun mm-hmm. as a plate. We always yeah. go the around the outside, and the mm-hmm. center of the plate is the sun.
Yeah.
It's also on that same orbit. It's just a smidge farther out than we are.
Huh.
It's also going slower than we are, which is why we won't see it again until 2017. The Earth was going faster, caught up to it, mm-hmm. and then raced ahead. And now we've got to go all the way around until we catch up with it again. If you think about the way I thought about it is if you've ever seen two people on a track running, mm-hmm. and they're running at almost the same speed, but the person in the lead is a little faster, mm-hmm. and it takes them, in this case, 16 and a half loops mm-hmm. or revolutions of the track to get back to that other person.
To lap.
That's exactly it. Sure. We mm-hmm. haven't lapped it again.
But, you know, I believe it's also something somewhat out of the plane of the ecliptic. My understanding of it, and the ecliptic is a plate that you were talking about.
Right.
If you imagine that as a the orbits
mm-hmm. as
of
a
all the
plane.
Planets as a flat, that's called the ecliptic. And so, otherwise, we would be seeing it probably more often than once a year. We're seeing it like once a year.
Well, no, it's almost at the same revolution around the sun as we are, mm-hmm. just slightly slower. So mm-hmm. our distance is always growing, mm-hmm. and until we eventually catch up to mm-hmm. it.
Yeah.
Now, it might be on a slightly different plane, but yeah. it's essentially the same.
That's so. Yeah. So that's my first kind of flag, I guess, is that I don't know hardly anything about astrophysics or whatever we call this, space science. I don't know anything about it.
Orbital mechanics.
Right.
Kind of thing.
You know, yeah. intuitively, you think if you're going to go on the same axis as something, the size of the planets or the whatever bodies are going to be about the same. Right, that they would orbit at the same kind of rate and the same distance from the sun mm-hmm. as to not be pulled in closer. And, you know, I don't know that that's true or not. It's just, you know, in my like little pretty basic mm-hmm. understanding of space, planets get bigger as they go away from the sun, right?
Not necessarily.
Yeah, mostly. But no, they have to. Generally, the given mass, the closer it is to the sun, uh-huh. the faster it will have to move in its
right.
orbit.
So that's, I get, you know, that's my kind of thing is that if this thing is, if it's pretty small, it's like 30.
10 meters across.
Yeah. yeah.
About.
Yeah. So for me, for it to be in the same orbit and to be going about the same speed as us, I don't know. Uh-huh. It just speaks of like a weird mass issue to mm-hmm. me. But I could be wrong. As I said, I don't really know anything about this stuff.
I think that mm-hmm. it's mostly dependent upon getting caught in the orbit of the sun and our solar system and just kind of brushed along. If you think about there's inertia,
yeah.
you just keep going.
Sure, but you, I guess the thing is, right, you have to have a certain amount of mass to stay that far out in an orbit to not get pulled in.
Not necessarily. Think about asteroid fields.
Yeah, it's more like the speed of it than anything else. But if it was an object that just sort of wandered in from interstellar space mm-hmm. and took up residence in the solar system, it would be extremely unlikely that it would adopt. I mean, it would probably get start orbiting the sun, but a nearly perfectly circular orbit that mimics ours,
yeah.
that's extremely unlikely. I mean,
and that's exactly
so that's
it. Is
yeah.
we never that saw is. It before. Suddenly, this thing appears, and it looks as if it's not. It looks as if it was made. Mm-hmm. It's not a natural formation, and we just don't know anything. And that's the weird thing about it is nobody really knows what the heck this thing is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there's a good number of theories running around about it. And some of them I think are plausible and some I don't. And unfortunately, I've been able to shoot holes in just about every one of them.
Mm-hmm.
But let's run through them.
Sure.
Okay, let's hear it.
So the first one is what Joe was talking about, is that it's a random asteroid that just wanders into our solar system and gets caught.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There is, according to some research, there's a field of asteroids that are in our solar system, and occasionally some of those do come out of there and they come into revolution around the sun.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is they're not on the same ecliptic. So if you think about you hold a plate mm-hmm. and that's our orbit around the sun, and then you take another plate, but you rotate it several degrees,
yeah.
they're at a different angle to each other.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
they're not in perfect unison going outwards like the planets mostly are from us.
Sure.
So that's part of the problem, is that those meteors or asteroids wouldn't be able to catch in our orbit.
Mm-hmm. It's also, you know, it's even conceivable that there have been some rocks just left over from the formation of the Earth and the Moon.
And there's a ton of that kind of stuff floating
along with us in virtually the same orbit as us, but we didn't have the technology to detect them until pretty recently.
Very true.
Wait, and how close did it come to us? Like compared to the Moon?
290,000 miles was, or a million miles, excuse me, 290,000 miles, which is about 50,000 miles beyond the orbit of the Moon.
Okay.
So it's pretty stinking
really
close.
Really close.
Yeah.
We could have flown out and met it had we known it was there.
Well, so that was going to be my other question is, like, why did it get stuck in the Sun's orbit but not ours, right? Because it's smaller than the Moon,
mm-hmm.
and our gravity's pretty dang strong. Mm-hmm. So if it was going to orbit something and it's like getting that close to us.
Mm. Well, here's the other problem with the, it's a random bit of space rock.
Mm-hmm.
Its orbit is a little eccentric. In other words, it's unstable.
Mm.
So when you look at celestial bodies, you look at them in terms of millennia.
Uh-huh.
How long can it go? And it's been there for eons and eons. This thing is unstable. Based on when we passed it 91, evidently they detected fluctuations in its orbit, which means that the gravitation of the Earth and the Moon themselves threw its pitch off a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So in the long run, if it's been there forever and ever, it should have already hit the Earth or the Moon because we...
Or gone somewhere else.
Messed up its orbit enough by passing it 91 that we could tell that we threw it out of loop a little bit. So, you know, in that grand scale that we look at things in space, we basically should have rear-ended it all. Right.
And really, to be fair, I mean, it's close enough that even, you know, 16 years before 1991, our stuff was sophisticated enough that we should have been able to see it then too, right?
We could have, but you got to remember that 16 years prior, that's 1975, mm-hmm. our science is not that good. Most of what we were observing in space was done by the human eye. And the sky is a huge area. What is it? SETI looks at the sky constantly, and they're able to watch 3%.
Yeah, but if something passes that close, you kind of think.
Yeah, I think I think the real key to that to actually finding little bitty objects buzzing around in space is it really is computers. I mean,
yeah,
the signals processing.
That's probably true.
Because there's so much stuff out there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so you gotta have.
And it's really hard to detect something that's blinking every 7.5 minutes.
That's true.
When you're just panning across,
yeah.
Like, oh, there's a bright spot. Keep going,
mm-hmm.
and then you come back and you don't really realize that it's gone,
sure.
or you don't notice that it's turned back on.
That's
so
fair.
Yes.
All right, that's fair.
So
my whole poking isn't as effective as yours, apparently.
Yeah.
Sorry, everybody.
Yeah, so that's the asteroid theory, the mm-hmm. stray asteroid theory.
So the next theory is that it is man-made space junk.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, like refuse from our various...
Everything we've ever put into space dang near that didn't come crashing back down is still up there.
Yeah.
Although,
yeah, there's not that many things that we put into space that have actually achieved escape velocity.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's not that many of those.
Most of the things we put into space, we know where they're at.
It's mostly either still in orbit around the planet or it's crashed back down to Earth.
Exactly.
The best conversations I have with my colleagues are the ones that happen when no one is looking, when we're not 100% sure yet what to write.
Hopefully, having conversations like this can help you figure out your own point of view. That's kind of our job as Washington Post opinions columnists. I'm Charles Lane, Deputy Opinion Editor.
And I'm Amanda Ripley, a contributing columnist. We're going to bring you into these conversations on a new podcast called Impromptu.
Follow Impromptu now, wherever you listen.
Nobody wants to outlive their money, but it happens, especially for women. That's why Gainbridge offers the Parity Flex annuity. It's designed for women's unique retirement needs, with flexible withdrawals to help cover unexpected expenses, plus a guaranteed lifetime income benefit that keeps paying you even if your account balance is zero. In other words, it's like getting a paycheck for life. We'll say that again. A paycheck for life. Guaranteed. Sounds too good to be true? It's not. It's the Parity Flex annuity. And it's one more example of their commitment to creating a better financial future for women. One where they feel empowered, not excluded, and ready to take on whatever their next chapter holds. Gainbridge believes financial flexibility and security are things we all could use more of. At retirement income you can't outlive is the ultimate flex. Who's with us? Start saving now at GameBridge.io. Please visit GameBridge.io/ParityFlex for current rates, full product disclosures and disclaimers, and other important information.
So there is a one piece of research that I really, really liked. And it talks about the fact that, yes, if 1991 VG is man-made, that would explain the reflective quality of it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because it's a chunk of a rocket. It's a mm-hmm. flat piece. And everything we put up, obviously, is metallic. So mm-hmm. it's going to reflect light and spin. Simple solution. So like I said, there's a ton of that junk that we've just spewed into space, and it's floating up mm-hmm. there. Well, if it is man-made, again, obviously it makes sense that it's going to wink on and off as it spins, because typically they're relatively flat shapes, or they're round and cylindrical, and mm-hmm. so this all makes sense. It simplifies it. I found some fantastic research by a guy named Dr. Duncan Steele. He's an astronomer. He, at the time, was a researcher at the Anglo-Australian Observatory.
Oh.
And yeah, he's a research fellow at the University of Adelaide. So this guy he's made his marks.
Sure. Mm.
So he's known as being very critical of a lot of things. He's pragmatic. He doesn't just jump to conclusions. Mm-hmm. But he did a bunch of research and a bunch of math on 1991 VG. And here's what he came up with. He calculated the gravitational orbit of 1991 VG, and this mm-hmm. is again with his best guess information from when it was first observed to when we lost it.
Sure.
And he tracked that back, and he's one of the ones that figured out that we're going to see it in 16 and a half years approximately. Uh-huh. So he took that time scale and he rolled it back, which means that it would have gone by us in 1975 mm-hmm. and it would have gone by us in late 1958. Mm-hmm. So if it is space junk that we put up there, should come from one of those two time frames. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, nothing in the 50s was big enough. Yeah. And almost every piece of junk that we put up there was small, and almost every piece of it came right back down to the planet.
Mm-hmm. Right. And again, in the late 50s, I don't think we ever achieved any escape velocity from the planet, necessary.
It all came home, so we're pretty sure it can't be any of that.
Had to be from the mid-70s if it was man-made junk.
Which means 75.
Yeah.
We did put up some things which, you know, he said it's possible that it was a part of Helios 1, which went into orbit in 1974, and it could be the rocket fragments from that, or it could be part of Vera 9, which was the rocket from Vera 9, which was sent to the probe itself, I guess, was sent to Venus or out towards Venus in 1975.
We speculated
it could have been part of that. Mm-hmm. But the time frame, he's saying it should have come by us in 1974, so this doesn't really work out. All of these launches, nothing that was big enough went up in 1974 to then get knocked into orbit.
When was the last Apollo launch?
The last Apollo launch was in the late 70s, and the Apollo launches will come into play here in a couple of minutes. We're definitely going to talk about those.
Yeah.
But other than the Apollo launches, there was nothing big enough in that time frame that could have been knocked into orbit and therefore be 1991 VG.
I guess, though, I kind of think, how stable is its orbit, right? Because we were kind of talking about, you know, it goes a little wonky when it came past us. Mm-hmm. And if it was our space junk, maybe it was moving faster, right? So it was like from more recent, right? So the first time we, quote, passed it, when it was basically launched from us, or we passed it.
Mm-hmm.
Was it more recent, and it went around that one time, but slowed down while it was going around.
Because it hit our gravity well.
Yeah. And then so it would continue to slow down. So we wouldn't see it for another, you know, couple years. But it would make sense to me that perhaps it would be slowing down in its orbit. Potentially, maybe, but.
Potentially.
Yeah. It's not. You'd think in space,
stay in motion. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not going to slow down.
Unless they run into a lot of objects that bump them around. And actually, bumping them around is part of what Dr. Steele was saying. Potentially, it could be, as if it was a chunk of a rocket that we sent up, it could be that it was something that went into orbit that we launched into orbit around the Earth or the Moon or ourselves, and then it got thrown off by the gravity well, or actually ran into the Moon and was kicked off into space, and then just went bouncing around and got locked into orbit because of that. So it should have been around us, but we accident—you know—the Moon accidentally bumped into it. It had a fender bender, essentially.
Or I mean, you know, or even this was, you know, like a conglomerate of rocks and like whatever, and it encountered because it came close enough that maybe like if something knocked something out, a piece of metal or whatever, and it got incorporated into this thing, right? As it was like a everything was in perfect harmony, it got knocked into this thing. That's why we hadn't seen it really before. It wasn't being reflective because it didn't have our space junk in it yet.
It may not have been spinning at that time. It may have run into some junk that made it tumble into space.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know.
It's again, that's, you know, if it's man-made, the numbers don't seem to fit.
Well, at least
I don't know.
Man-made, right?
Right. Yeah. If it's earthly man-made.
Yeah.
So let's move on to our next theory. And the third theory, I didn't ever come across in my research per se. It just never really sprang up for some reason. But I did have a brief email conversation with Dr. Steele.
Oh.
Because I wanted to get his take on it and try to get an opportunity to chat with him. And he wasn't interested in it because he is, since he put out his paper in 95, he's changed his thoughts on it.
Okay.
He's now of the group that believes that 1991 VG is a part of Apollo 12's Saturn V rocket, specifically the third stage of the rocket, which is an S-4B rocket.
Yeah.
So he said, well, now it's pretty conclusive to me that it's the S-4B and that's it.
Yeah.
Which makes sense because these rockets are pretty stinking big. And let me give you the background on what happened with Apollo 12. They went up when they launched Apollo 12. The ship, I think it was hit twice by lightning on launch, which messed up a lot of their systems. And they had some serious problems. They didn't know if they were going to be able to continue the mission or if they were even going to be able to make it home. They get into space, controls are all messed up. Eventually, ground control and the astronauts themselves, they figured out how to make things work, and they were able to get the stages to go, to release, and to send the lunar lander away, which eventually did land on the Moon, and there's all the photos in the world on the internet to see that. What happened, though, is that what NASA intended to do is, in a previous launch, they had taken the third stage of one of the rockets and they had crashed it into the Moon. And this time they wanted to go ahead and not crash it into the Moon, but send it specifically into orbit around the Moon. When they went to do that, there was some miscalculation and
had a little slingshot effect, did they?
They pushed it too fast.
Yeah. Apollo 12, as far as I know, there was no problem with that mission. So it sounds like you're confusing that with Apollo 13.
No. Apollo 12, they had a lot of problems at launch. Once they were up and they figured it out, they were able to get everything running. 13 is where they had some major issues. But 12 had some weird stuff in the beginning. And this was all during the launch sequence. Once they lifted off, systems went wonky.
Why did they want to put the thing in orbit of
The
Moon?
I don't know why they wanted to do that. I think it was to see if they could do it. Yeah. I'm guessing.
I think, yeah, I really think that they were just dinking around. I mean, the thing either goes and crashes on the Moon, or that goes just off into space or whatever.
Yeah, and they said, let's see if we can control this thing. Yeah, let's see if we can launch it, you know, and put it in orbit around the Moon. Unfortunately, it burned too long when they were venting the gases, and it shuttled out of the moon's gravitational field and disappeared.
Sure.
According to the research that I've seen, it was in a semi-stable orbit around the Earth and the moon for a couple of years until it escaped our orbit in 71.
Okay.
So here's the easy way to think about it. It gets kicked up, it circles us for a while, but its orbit's a little off, and then eventually it escapes the gravitational pull and then just goes and does its own thing in space.
But how big are those things? Are they really that big?
58 feet long. They're fairly large. But
yeah,
it's
they're big. They're big. They're a rocket. I mean, think about the rockets you see you know, in all the photos of Cape Canaveral when they're launching. That's a big chunk of rocket.
Yeah, it's just the third stage, so it's the smallest part of it, but it's actually, but it's also the only part of the rocket that achieves escape velocity.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the only part. It's the only part of the rocket that's going to go in orbit around the sun versus in orbit around the moon.
So scientists think that it's big enough to actually be this monolithic.
Yeah. Well. Yeah. If it's 10 meters across, it's about 30 feet.
Aren't those things painted?
Yeah, they're painted white and black, which. There's another interesting factoid. They're white and black. That explains the blinking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That would, the reflectivity of it. Plus, if it's a cylinder, it's not going to have a perfect rotation against us. So it's
going
to twist.
They're painted in lines, black and white. So it would.
Or is it a checker?
The stage, actually, I'm looking at a picture of it right now. The stage is actually painted pretty much all white. And then the bottom, there's a cone at the bottom. That flares out, that mates up with the wider second stage, mm-hmm. and that is painted white with a couple of black stripes. So you can see that cone right there, that's black and white, and then the top of it has got a white stripe around it also.
So I guess I could see how, like, the optical illusion in space, if it were, like, straight, vertical lines, that, you know, the black and the white in contrast with each other, you know, that's in painting. That's how you make a corner look like it's a thing, right? So I guess I could see that. But looking at that picture, I don't know that it makes a lot of sense for half of it to be reflective and half of it to not be, right?
But it's also conceivable that the mating cone that basically fared it in with the rocket, the stage below it, which is wider, that thing would be about 30 feet in diameter at its widest point.
Uh-huh.
And that was painted black and white.
Yeah.
So if that came apart, off of the rest of the rocket, that would be roughly the size of our object.
It would be. You know, but here's my problem. Okay, again, I don't like to do this when I give theories, immediately turn around and poke holes into them.
Don't lie.
I do. Yeah. But, well, today's show is a prime candidate of Steve doing that, because here's my problem with the theory that 1991 VG is the SB4 stage of the Saturn V rocket.
Mm-hmm.
In 2002, amateur astronomer Bill Young spotted something in space that was moving, and that object is identified as J002E3.
Mm-hmm.
That object, they did a electromagnetic spectrum analysis of it, which, again, that's a science that's beyond me.
Mm-hmm.
But what they figured out is that it was consistent, that analysis showed it was consistent with white titanium dioxide, which was the paint that was used on the Saturn V rockets. So that's object number two that we're saying is the third stage of the rocket from Apollo 12.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a bunch of garbage, like we said before, floating around the Earth and around our solar system. And though not all of them wink, there's some things that do. And lo and behold, there's another one. September 29 of 2000. This is two astronomers at the University of Hawaii. They find a near-Earth object, and they catalog it as 2000 SG344. This particular object was within 4,800,000 miles of Earth, or about 20 times farther out from Earth than 1991 VG was.
Okay.
Yeah.
But when it got close, the object appeared to be about 100 to 200 feet in diameter, depending on its consistency, because that you know, the brightness is hard to measure. But when they took a look at it, they noticed that it wasn't acting like an asteroid. So again, it was winking. They went ahead and they decided, well, has this thing been up there? Have we seen it for a while now? And the scientists did find photos from May of 1999 in their archives in around the same area, essentially. And they discovered it and they went ahead and plotted its trajectory and figured out that it would have come around us approximately in 1971. And they say that this particular piece of space junk is also the third stage of the Apollo 12 rocket. So why is Apollo 12 the, you know, the whipping boy of all these people? Is because we don't know what happened to it. It slingshotted out into space and then we lost it and they don't know where it's at. And so everybody is saying that this, that, and the other is that piece of rocket.
It might be that it broke up into a couple of pieces, so it might actually be in a couple of different places too.
But its size, everything that they say is going to be this chunk of Saturn V rocket, is about the same size. So unless it bred in space, and, you know,
they found a nice
little rocket kittens. I don't think it's it.
I guess
the Hawaii one makes the most sense to me, right? That it, you know, they estimated it probably would have been there around 71, which is around when, you know, we lost the thing. And
that's about Apollo 12 time.
So I'm hesitant to say that it's Apollo 12.
Me too.
Which leads me to our last, our
aliens.
Fourth.
Is it aliens?
It is.
Right on.
We're finally doing aliens?
We're finally doing aliens.
Oh my goodness.
Well, we never done aliens before?
No.
Yes, we have.
Really? When?
Well, not in space, but on this Earth. We've run to aliens in a
bunch of aliens a few times.
All right. So here's the final theory about what 1991 VG is. There's a bunch of people who say that it is something from an alien civilization. Specifically, they are saying that it's a Bracewell probe. Have you ever heard of a Bracewell probe?
Yeah.
Okay. For anybody who doesn't know what a Bracewell probe is, essentially the theory goes, and this was first theorized by a gentleman by the name of Ronald Bracewell in 1960, and he said that because travel between pieces in the galaxy or places in the galaxy are so long and it's hard to send transmissions like radio waves, you could send a probe, and that probe would be autonomous. It would be essentially self-sustaining, and it would look for what it considered an intelligent species or a planet that could possibly have intelligence on it at some point. Once it found that intelligence, it would communicate with that species in some way and then alert its original, the species that sent it out, and then we could all get together and have a galactic chat over tea.
Like, and they could exterminate us and take our planet.
It's essentially a more sophisticated Voyager, right? You know, we've done what we could at that point. Voyager that has all of our information on it. It doesn't broadcasts, right? Does it broadcast something?
Voyager?
Yeah. It broadcasts back to us, so it must
be. Yeah, it does send signals back to
something, you know, so, but it doesn't, you know, search. It's not an intelligence of any kind.
Right. Yeah. It's just a floating probe. We're hoping for somebody else to find it, whereas this would be looking for somebody. And actually, I know you, Devin, will love this. The Bracewell probe was the basis for the original story that 2001 A Space Odyssey was based upon. So that's, if you've ever seen that movie, that obelisk was a Bracewell probe.
That's why they buried it on the moon, you know, because when man is sophisticated enough to actually go to the moon and actually find this thing and dig it up, and then the sun hits it, and that's when it sends off its little message to us. Yeah.
But people say, well, it's a Bracewell object, and so it's circling our planet. It's just recently found us, and it's waiting for us to come back around and be smart enough to communicate with it so that it can introduce us to everybody else that's in the universe.
I was going to say it's waiting for us to be smart enough to go fish it out of there, right?
Let's just go send
a fishing line out there and pull it back in. What's the problem?
Maybe that's the way it works. I don't know. I mean, Bracewell objects are in sci-fi stuff all over the place. Every intelligent probe is a Bracewell, but nobody knows that that actually is going to happen.
Yeah.
Bracewell himself just kind of made it up. It's theory.
Well, because, you know, artificial intelligence elsewhere in the universe that coexists at the same time as we are also intelligent is a statistic improbability.
And well, you know, you're talking a lot of distance, and not just that, but a lot of objects to examine, a lot of solar systems, you know, to send your probes to.
Absolutely.
Although it's not as many as we think. As it turns out, they just did a study. They call them the Goldilocks planets, right? Not too hot, not too cold, perfect for life that we recognize by our, you know, laws of physics and whatever would be able to harbor intelligent life, right? Earth-like planets.
Okay.
That have what we understand to be the basic building blocks of. I understand there are theories out there about there being other types of aliens, but in our galaxy, there are only 104 planets.
104 so far?
No. Like, at all.
That we can identify. And the Goldilocks zone, correct me if I'm wrong, is planets that are approximately the same distance away from a sun like ours or are getting the same amount of radiation to equate that distance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that it's a really narrow band. It's a ribbon.
Oh, it is.
It's a very narrow ribbon around a sun that can hold a planet that we know of that can harm life.
Right. So,
I'm curious about is that they've found. They've identified, I think, just to clarify, it sounds like they've identified 104 so far, but they haven't. That's not a comprehensive study, correct?
Well, I mean, it's.
I mean, they haven't examined the entire galaxy.
It's not based on examination, it's based on calculations. But so that's, that's a pretty astoundingly low number.
It is, but it's a statistical achieved number, and you know how statistics are. It's hard to say because you've got a small pool that you can observe. It would be like saying there are only X number of one-bedroom apartments in a 30-block radius in my town, and that means there's only X number total in the city.
Right, but so I guess my argument on that is that if we were to send out a probe, we would start with those 104 Goldilocks planets, would any alien.
That'd be the criteria
race,
that it would be looking for.
Right, so they would send that to something that looked like Earth, ostensibly, right?
Yeah.
We're making some vast assumptions here.
Very vast.
Some pretty big assumptions here. But if there were an alien race in our galaxy, which you kind of assume they're probably in our galaxy, right? For it to make it here, but maybe not, maybe it's from some completely different galaxy, but let's just say they're in our galaxy, they send it to the similar Goldilocks things, there's only 104. Okay.
Yeah.
They found it. It's not that long to find life, intelligent life.
Well, I mean, it's a long distance to travel. And
that's why you send a probe, right?
Exactly. That's why you send a probe. So you don't go, nothing here.
I know. This sucks. Yeah.
By the time we got here, you know, it fell apart.
They killed each other by the time we got here.
I got to say that if they have an interstellar probe that's only about 10 meters long, then we have to snag that thing and take a look at it.
Oh, yeah.
With known technologies, these are not technologies that we're exploring now or that we actually have. Mm-hmm. You know, we've talked about them. They're theorized.
Yeah, we have a
theoretically
lot of things
possible.
Around grabbing stuff out of space. Yeah. We've just never done it.
Yeah, I'm just talking about an interstellar drive. There's like things like ramjets that just use random hydrogen that exists between the stars. But they tend to be very large structures. Mm-hmm. So I'd be really interested in something that's only 10 meters long, that's capable of interstellar travel.
Yeah.
That's some technology we need to get our hands on.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Seriously.
No kidding.
Kidding. So, yeah, I hate to say it, but I think alien.
You really like this theory.
I like the alien theory. I think it's the best theory.
And honestly, I'm out of theories. That's the hard part. These are the main things that I could come across, you know, as generalizations. Yeah. I don't know. I'm waiting.
Honestly, look at, like, of those theories that you have, what is the most plausible? Like, if you just, like, okay, in your mind, accept that aliens exist.
I think that from what I can tell in the research, I believe that it's a metallic object that is an engineered object.
Okay.
The meaning that it's not random space rock.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Now, is that engineered objects of junk that we put up that somehow stuck itself together and now has an orbit? Mm-hmm. Or we did or somebody else did? I don't know.
Here's the thing we're overlooking is Russia.
Russia?
Dude, that country's big enough. They could have launched some stuff into orbit without us ever knowing.
Very true.
Nah, we would know about it. I mean, we watch their rocket launches pretty carefully. We've been doing it for a long time. Because of that, there's that whole thing about ICBMs and all that stuff. So
That's what those asteroids, they keep getting hit with asteroids. They're not asteroids.
They're accidental returning spaceships.
Yeah.
Interstellar boomerangs.
They're using it to cover. Yeah.
Yeah, could be.
Like, oh, something hit here. We don't know what it was. Oh, there's no debris. Weird.
Oh,
we definitely didn't launch something instead of it hitting.
Yeah. Well, I personally don't know what it is.
Yeah.
But ladies and gentlemen, I will encourage you to go to our website because we have the links about this particular story. And there is a fantastic link that we're going to put up that will actually allow you to watch 1991 VG in its orbit around the sun.
No, let's be very clear. It's just like a little computer simulation. Well,
it's really
informative.
It's very informative. Yeah. Exactly. I understood it so much better once I watched that. So I know we're going to include that and some of the other bits that I've found here. So that'll be good. That website, as always, is going to be thinkingsidewayspodcast.com. You can listen to the show right there on the website. You can go ahead and listen to us on Stitcher. If you're on the go, you don't have time to download it. You can just listen to it right on your mobile phone, your smartphone. Or if you want, you can always go ahead and go to iTunes and download the show right there.
And leave us a rating.
Yeah. If you're on iTunes and you're liking what you're hearing, go ahead and leave us a comment or a rating. Heck, if you want, you can even go ahead and send us an email to tell us, A, what you thought of the show, or B, what your thoughts for this particular story are.
Or C, if you have stories you want to hear.
Or if you have stories you want to hear, that would be awesome. We've gotten some good ones.
We've gotten some really good ones.
By the way, I got to share some stuff. We've got some good stuff recently, and I got to share that with you. I've been keeping it in my coat pocket.
Yeah.
I haven't been sharing with you, and I'm going to do that.
You're holding out on us. Where's my gun?
Yeah, holding out on you. That email address that you can go ahead and get a hold of us at is going to be thinkingsidewayspodcast@gmail.com.
Wow. That's a big email address.
It is a big email address. And last, but most certainly not least, go ahead and find us and friend us on Facebook. We're there. We put up bits of information that we come across
sometimes.
And upcoming stories. So go ahead and find us on there, and I know you'll enjoy it.
Mm.
And with that having been said, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to go ahead and call it a night. So talk to you soon.
Night, everybody.
We're orbiting out of here.
Number one, out. Make it so.
Yeah.
Welcome back. What if we told you about a major breakthrough on awesome savings on all-inclusive beach vacays?
OMG, this could break the case.
Case? I'm talking about CheapCaribbean.com.
Ooh, is it full of chilling intrigue?
No, it's full of hot savings. CheapCaribbean.com's semi-annual sale is helping you save $200 off your next booking for 4 nights or more. Score site-wide deals to your favorite beaches in Cancun, Aruba, Jamaica, and more now through the end of April.
We gotta take this show on the road.
Let's start at CheapCaribbean.com.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.